On the last episode of Obscured, we heard from Chester Holman III, who spent nearly 3 decades in prison for a murder he did not commit. He talked to us about managing his mental health after being exonerated and helping other exonerees working to rebuild their lives.
I had so many fears, nightmares. I was disconnected to my family. You know, even though I was putting on the face, I was just inside. I was just scared and lost. And I've made great strides to where I'm at now, but it's been a battle. People wouldn't think that. They think because I got the lawsuit and everything, you're free, that life is just okay now, but it's not what it seems, you know. You spend that much time preparing yourself mentally and physically to die. And now you're like, no, stop. It's time to live. And it's like, how do you reverse that? You know, so that's what I'm in the process of trying to tell.
This is Obscured, the podcast from Kuvenda Media about critical issues that don't get much attention because they're complex, overshadowed, and happen largely out of the public eye. I'm Emily Previty, co-creator and executive editor of Obscured. On this limited series, From Words to Weapons, we're focused on survivors of law enforcement trauma. Through our reporting, we've learned there's a small network of researchers and policymakers around the U.S. who are thinking about how to support people who've experienced traumatic encounters with law enforcement. To better understand what that might entail, my colleague Stephanie Maroudis and I have been talking to public health practitioners who've done adjacent work. The idea was to learn about any models that might be analogous and provide more context overall about these sorts of interventions.
On this episode, Emily and I speak with Philadelphia-based public health researcher Arturo Zinni. Arturo is executive director of Drexel University's Center for Nonviolence and Social Justice, where he previously served as director of Healing Hurt People, which helps individuals cope with community violence. He's also a Stoneley Foundation fellow and is researching how evidence-based trauma-informed practices affect the mental health of youth survivors of violence. As we'll hear, Arturo will share that he does not typically see clients referred because of law enforcement trauma, but it does come up in talking to people he's counseled who are coping with community violence.
Arturo will also talk about navigating relationships with institutions and communities with lived experience, and what takeaways there might be for people working to address law enforcement trauma.
You know, we approached you to talk with us for our podcast, which is focused on supporting survivors of law enforcement trauma. And so in that early work, in your current work, does that come up at all?
What we've seen and what I've seen is a deep mistrust of the police by, you know, our communities, which are mostly, you know, Black and Latino. So we hear that when we meet with people and we get to know them, that they don't feel safe or protected necessarily by the police. But the referrals that we get usually are people who are harmed within their own communities by oftentimes the members of their communities, which we know they're the minority who are committing crimes, but we haven't gotten referrals due to police brutality specifically.
Even if it's not a referral specific to that, even in talking to people who referred for other reasons, it sounds like it does come up that people will say that they're not feeling protected, but that's pretty much the extent of it.
Yes.
And then you mentioned mistrust toward law enforcement, but there's broader mistrust in institutions, including hospitals and higher education and some of the institutions that are perhaps trying to help people create progress, find solutions. But at the same time, some institutions may have perpetuated or created or upheld, exacerbated some of the very issues that you might be working to address, and you're also looking at community-based solutions. So what are some of the challenges and opportunities of trying to integrate all that and balance it and address the mistrust?
You know, we work with people who, on average, have deep mistrust of organizations that they have interacted with, where it's like, as you said, hospital system, healthcare, educational, child welfare, sometimes juvenile justice, right? So they felt they've been underserved. A lot of times the services that they received were not culturally sensitive. They were not, aware of the deep trauma that the communities have experienced, right? And how you want to engage with people who have gone through trauma, you know, honoring their voices and really, first of all, acknowledging the amazing resilience that our communities show, and at the same time, being mindful of their challenges. And you mentioned the hospital system, and Dr. John Rich and Dr. Ted Corvin, who founded Healing Her People and the Center for Nonviolence and Social Justice in 2007, they're physicians, right? And the main reason why they created, which was the first hospital-based violence intervention program in the state of Pennsylvania, was because they saw specifically young Black men who were coming after being injured in the community, mostly gunshot wounds, and they were treated at the hospital for the physical wounds, but then they were sent back to communities without receiving support for like their social needs or their mental health needs. So that's why it all started. And to your point, part of what we do is we work through an anti-racist framework, and being culturally sensitive, it's really what drives what we do. So I think that goes to the second part of what you were mentioning. Although I do believe that as providers, professionals, we have an expertise that is important, it's both and. The community also, there's a wealth of knowledge and wisdom and working together to find solutions. So for example, there's different programs that are wonderful and we partner with, such as EMIR, Every Murder is Real, which was started after the founder's brother was murdered. So she started this organization that serves family members who had loved ones murdered or lost to gun violence. Other programs that focus on empowering youth, like Yeah Philadelphia, and working Black-led organizations, which I think it's so important, like knowing that probably around 85% of gun violence victims identify as African-American. And then, you know, I could name a lot of other examples.
Can you think of a tangible example where those two approaches are integrated?
So the gold standard for child trauma therapy that we use at Healing Her People is called trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy. It's a very well-researched, evidence-based practice that has been implemented across the United States, in Europe, even in different countries in Africa, such as Rwanda, for example, and has proven to be highly effective in helping children and caregivers heal from trauma, from like not just post-traumatic stress disorder, but anxiety, behavior problems, depression, etc. So that's a sort of very well-researched modality that we use at Healing Her People. And we meet with the child and the family, child and the caregiver, really, for up to 20 weeks on average. That's the EBP part. And then you have our peer specialist role, which is young people with parallel experiences of violence, similar to the youth that we serve, who are trained within our center and become full-time employees. And they play a critical role. For example, when we go to the hospital, we work at St. Christopher's Hospital, and a peer specialist engages the child and the family. And a lot of times being able to talk to someone who has had similar experiences than you helps with that, the mistrust we were talking about. So it helps to like build that bridge between the community and our program.
So you have this combination of evidence-based practices and practices that emerge from the community.
Yes.
And what have you seen, you know, over your years doing this in terms of effectiveness? I mean, I'm not asking you to quantify it, but, you know, sort of qualitatively what you've noticed.
I think we're learning so much. So at Healing Hurt People, we've had peer specialists since 2013, and the integration with evidence-based practices, we've done it for the past 5 years. And I think it's complex, and it's important to acknowledge that, right? How you're making sure that the different pieces of the puzzle work well together, so the product that you're offering the family really helps them. So we do measure outcomes, both quantitative and qualitative. But to your point, regarding qualitative outcomes, we hear a lot of positive feedback from the people who we serve.
Do any outcomes kind of come to mind that you've heard that is making a positive impact?
I can tell you one of our interventions that grew out of the sanctuary model, and then they have a group called the SELF Groups, which stands for Safety, Emotion, Loss, and Future. And it was adapted by a colleague of ours, Tony Thompson, who works at the center. And now the group is called Cypher, because we realized that the youth, specifically Black and Latino youth, needed more culturally relevant interventions. So Cypher stands for Community of Young People Healing, Experiencing, and Rebuilding. And we have done ciphers at, you know, many schools. For example, last year we did a group at a school and we were going to do only 5 sessions. The group can go up to 10 sessions. And then when the therapist went back, I think it was for the last time with the peer specialist, the students had written all these notes to the principal and to the school counselors, like writing, like, we would love to have more. We need more of this intervention. This helped me identify my feelings. And I feel like, you know, I was respected and I enjoyed, I had fun. So students by themselves, like teenagers, which we know they don't do this often, had taken up to them to speak up and say, we need more of this. And I remember when the therapist shared the notes with me, it made all of ours, you know, our week.
And that included, you've done a lot of great work, it seems like, and have some outcomes to share and point to help maybe further that research, get support for more research and continue. So I don't know if what I'm about to describe has been your experience previously or earlier on, but we've talked to some people who are more specifically working on trying to support and study interventions for the population that we've spoken about, which is survivors of law enforcement trauma. And sometimes they face some backlash, whether it's from their own professional organization or it's an academic setting and maybe someone who's in a position of power relative to the earlier career researcher who might be asking sort of says, this isn't a thing, this isn't a problem. Did you ever have trouble or face resistance to getting support for your research?
I've been doing, you know, public health practice for 20 years, research maybe for 6 or 7 years. So what I will say that when it comes to Drexel, and to me, aligning when it comes to values is very important, right? Our school, Dornsife, sees health as a human right. And of course, it includes mental health. And Dornsife is big on health equity. And I would say not only I didn't feel resistance or sort of obstacles, but it's been like sort of the opposite, you know, like a very progressive environment in which I feel that we can do the research that needs to be done to improve outcomes for children and families who are impacted by trauma. And as you said, a lot of times we need to have very difficult conversations, right? So to mention, what's the role of the police, which we know it has to be a role of supporting and keeping communities safe. And, you know, if our communities are not seeing that way, right, if they don't feel safe, there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And even if that's not what my research is focusing on, but you bring a really good point, I think what I would say that's very important that, you know, a researcher needs the support of their institution. And I think there's a lot of examples where that's not the case, right? And then you're not able to do what you were meant to do.
I think what Emily has learned in her reporting is that whether solutions in the space, you know, are being slowed because of obstacles. And so why we call our series Obscured, it's sort of like, why is an issue not progressing or being solved, or what are other contributing factors? You know, we're obviously interested in solutions, but it's sort of like, why is it not front and center? So, you know, one of the reasons we wanted to talk to you was to learn about the work and research you've done in the space. And what Emily has also found in her reporting is that the same types of supports don't exist for survivors of law enforcement trauma, as opposed to other communities that might be going through trauma. So, you know, we're just looking at your work too as an analog, like, okay, what are potential solutions in the space, how to think about it, and, you know, the combination of evidence-based practices with practices that emerge from the community seems really like that has a lot of potential. Potentially, you could hear somebody who maybe had a law enforcement encounter talk to someone else who hasn't really processed that before.
Yeah, I think that's a really good analog. I can see that working and being healing for the individual.
The example that I usually give, because I think that there's been more public education and messaging around this population, is sexual assault survivors. Most of us probably know websites to go to, hotlines to call. And clearly, these interventions are works in progress too and aren't always executed in an ideal fashion. But we kind of know that generally, if someone presents, if it's in a clinic, if it's at an ER, there's a protocol in place, and sometimes law enforcement's called, sometimes they're not. Sometimes that's up to the survivor. There's a sexual assault kit, a medical exam that happens. There are referrals for follow-up medical care if that's necessary, a reference to an advocate that could coordinate legal services if that's something that the person needs, or mental health support. you're doing a similar wraparound sort of thing, but it's not executed in the same way, really.
One of the things that I believe make our program meaningful and relevant to our communities is that we really meet people wherever they prefer, and as long as there's safety and privacy, right? So we go to their homes, we go to schools, obviously we meet at the hospital, in the community, we have office space, both in downtown and at St. Christopher's Hospital. In the past, I've done a lot of office-based work, but I've also done community-based and home-based. And really, I think going to the community and seeing how people live, their homes, the schools, gives you such a much broader picture of that families, what they're going through. And then you get to advocate to your point of like, we're a provider for victims' compensation service, for example, which reimburses victims of crime for any cost associated with being victimized. We know, for example, that for our kids and thinking from a public health perspective, rep therapy won't solve all the issues. We need different levels of prevention and intervention, schools being a huge one. There's so much improvement despite huge efforts from the city and the School District of Philadelphia. You know, we know that, and we hear it all the time, that a lot of youth are not getting the education they deserve, right? And I could go on and on, but I think touching the different systems and making sure that they are culturally sensitive and anti-racist at all different levels, it's key.
On Obscured, we're covering issues that intersect with politics, government, and accountability. And we wanted to let you know about another show that's diving into big ideas about civic life and democracy. It's called Future Hindsight and is hosted by Mila Atmos. This award-winning podcast features conversations with changemakers and civic innovators and ideas for how citizens like you can take action to change the status quo and stay engaged. Find new episodes of the show every Thursday at futurehindsight.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
At Brooklyn Public Library, we're launching a new podcast series called Borrowed and Banned to help you understand how and why books are being removed from library shelves across the country and what you can do about it.
You don't ban Toni Morrison unless you are trying to prevent people understanding a very profound truth.
You know, it just brought me to a rage.
We're focusing on our education, but we're also out here fighting a fight that your generation was supposed to fight.
Subscribe to Borrowed and Banned wherever you find podcasts.
Now, let's get back to Obscured. Wondering if you could contextualize this within sort of a community incident. In particular, in Philadelphia, we had the unfortunate shooting at Roxborough High School in the fall of 2022. And we're aware that you and your colleagues were part of helping facilitate some community healing sessions and interventions. And wondering, you know, what that looked like. You know, how did you engage families? How did you engage students at that school?
Yeah, that's definitely was something that was, as you said, tragic. And, you know, one adolescent was murdered and four severely injured during the football game at Roxborough. And I will say, just to frame it, there are different things that I believe are important to sort of mention. Like the first thing, you know, the city responded very quickly, right? And the school district was involved. And I think many providers responded simultaneously because we all want to support. It was such a tragedy. And I think everybody doing violence prevention intervention work wanted to support Roxborough. What happened was, and sometimes I think that's a downside of, or something that needs to improve, is like, then the school gets bombarded with people trying to support and it ends up being confusing, right? So I think what happened with us is like, one of my coworkers, Rosemary Kamel, had a pre-existing relationship with Roxborough. She had served youth for several years at Roxborough, so they trusted her. And goes back to the trust piece. So the school responded to us. We had a meeting and they said, yes, please, we need your help. The next day we were there. But it started with that pre-existing trust that we had. And we went, and as you mentioned, Stephanie, I was part of the response. It was one of our peer specialists, a therapist. It was Jermaine, Amelia, Rosemary, and I. We met with, it was voluntary, of course. We invited everyone from the football team who had all witnessed the shooting. A total of 22 people showed up, 22 students and five staff members. So we were there. What was supposed to be a one-day intervention and offering support ended up in us being asked to come back. And we ended up providing the Cypher group that I mentioned earlier, the community of young people healing, experiencing, and rebuilding, myself and Jermaine, who's a peer specialist. I was actually following his lead there. And it was, to me, it's like also when you mentioned we talked about resiliency earlier, I was so impressed by this young boy's ability to just be present, be vulnerable in groups. Like, they were there every week, they were engaged, and how they were able to heal through relationships. And to me, that's the important part, right? That, yeah, maybe you don't trust the system, right? In this case, the educational and the mental health system, Drexel and the hospital. But institutions and systems are made of people. So what I saw there is like by Jermaine and I being there and with the rest of the team, then these young men, or they identified as male, all of them, had someone who they started to trust and they opened up. And we had a, you know, we were able to complete the group and all the youth completed their school year. That's another right measure, I think, of healing, and were able to stay connected. And also they were mentioning about receiving support from their own families, which is very important. It was supposed to be a one-time thing, and we ended up going for, I think, 10 consecutive weeks to meet with them.
The fact that you had that consistency,
yes,
and regularity that indicated to the students that they had support and could really carve out the time to be able to talk and process and make sense of it and grow or heal.
You know, as you were talking, another very important part, like, you know, with trauma interventions is providing extractor predictability, that consistency you mentioned, because a traumatic experience is the opposite of that, right? It's confusing. It might come after out of nowhere or not, but it's terrifying. It's confusing. It's chaotic, right? And personal boundaries are not respected when it's like interpersonal trauma. So making sure that the youth knew that we were going to be there every week, these are the topics that we're going to talk about. They also propose their own topics, but we have, and we're meeting every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Things like that, that I think are very important when working with survivors of violence.
You know, as part of your Stoneleigh Foundation Fellowship, you are conducting research around trauma-specific practices on the mental health needs of violently injured young people with a focus on racial and ethnic minorities and LGBTQ youth. Could you talk to us about what you're seeing in terms of the need for services and interventions within this group?
You know, it's a passion of mine. Part of my research focuses on LGBTQ youth, which I've worked with over a decade now. And what we have seen and why I want to focus on this is that LGBTQ youth, for the most part, do not access hospital-based violence intervention services. We know, and there's a lot of data out there, that LGBTQ youth are being victimized at significantly higher rates than their straight and cisgender peers. In Philly, specifically Black trans women. And for multiple reasons that we can hypothesize, they don't access services. I believe one of the reasons, you know, the same as we work hard to make the hospital system anti-racist and, you know, aware of the needs of racial minorities, the same needs to happen with LGBTQ youth. I think we're not there yet. I think there's a lot of efforts across the city of Philadelphia, but we need to do more. And it might start with something as simple as asking a youth, you know, like, what's your gender identity, right? What you identify as, like, what's your, you know, sex orientation? Of course, asking those questions in a way that are not threatening to the youth or not intrusive. So screening, it's a big part of it. But also making sure that, for example, we hear stories about trans youth who were hospitalized and the hospital staff was not respecting their pronouns. So the person went by she and they kept on calling her he, which was had been her sex assigned at birth. So things like that, that you can imagine how can be very negative, right? And that youth probably felt, well, I don't want services here, right? I want to go home as soon as possible. And, you know, those are some of the examples. And what I'm about to start doing through my research is interviewing LGBTQ youth in Philadelphia who have been victims of violence to learn more about their experiences. I want to hear from them to the point about solutions that come from the community. In this case, will be honoring the voices of their youth themselves. So for them to tell me, What have been the barriers to you accessing trauma services in general? What needs to change? What are your recommendations? What has gone well? Because I'm sure there's examples of success. But that's part of what I'm going to be doing with my research. And there's, you know, several interventions that have proven to work with LGBTQ youth, such as the Family Acceptance Project. There's an adaptation of TFCBT for LGBTQ youth. I was part of that learning collaborative and subsequent manual we published. And there's wonderful LGBTQ youth organizations in the city. But as I mentioned, when it comes to, you know, at a system level, there's a lot more that we need to do.
These interviews that you're doing, and then also quantitative internal research, is that expected to inform maybe some kind of additional pilot protocol for hospitals, training? What would you see as the next stage?
Thank you for asking that, because it's for both. For my research through Stoney and my dissertation work, it's focused on the work that we've done at Healing Her People with racial and ethnic minorities and then LGBTQ youth. So it's connecting both pieces, right? Knowing that at the end of the day, they're all vulnerable, marginalized populations, right? That deserve support and for us to do better, right? As a city when we interact with them. So my hope through the Stoney Fellowship is to develop implementation manuals, for example, for peer support. So peer support with youth impacted by violence, which will be inclusive of both groups, and a manual that we will co-author with community health worker peers and members from the community, and then eventually train providers who serve youth impacted by violence so they deliver services in a culturally sensitive, evidence-based way. And our goal is to partner with, as I mentioned, there's a lot of really important work being done with the Philadelphia Alliance for Child Trauma Services, which is part of the Department of Behavioral Health, with the Hospital-Based Violence Intervention Coalition at the Department of Public Health, and the developers of trauma-focused CBT. So all coming together to your point, like having a manual, implementation manual, I think it's a very concrete tool that we hope will help multiple programs working with violently injured youth.
And bringing it back to the focus of the obscured reporting on support for law enforcement, trauma survivors, you know, having professionals who are competently trained, who can understand the population who they're serving. But, you know, it's almost like another screening tool, you know, in case, like, have you had a law enforcement trauma? That potentially could be one solution in this space in the future, right? The way, like, what you've talked about in your work.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Screening is very important and adding those questions. And, you know, on the flip side, it's sort of, as you were speaking, it reminded me during my work with the city, with the Philadelphia Alliance for Child Trauma Services, we conducted several trainings for police officers on understanding youth and adolescent development and what youth impacted by trauma, you know, some triggers, for example, like for youth who have experienced a lot of community violence or domestic violence, and suddenly someone, an officer raising their voice, can be very triggering, right? So how can you properly approach that youth so the interaction is safe for everybody? And we did a series of that trainings with Camilla Jackson, who I work with. And I think that's an example of something that a system that needs also support to then support adolescents in this case. And there was a very positive response. This was ages ago, maybe 10 years ago.
I went to a symposium recently at Penn, and one of the attorneys who was there presented on, you know, sort of the differences with a lot of stuff that many of us know, but they integrated into like law enforcement practice, which was the differences in the brain of emerging adults. And there are certain protocol where police should be treating that population differently because, you know, there isn't the same level of awareness as in a fully formed brain. This has to do with interrogation techniques mostly. I don't know if that really had anything to do with what you were doing.
Yeah, I know. It definitely did. I mean, it included, yeah, talking about brain development. And as you said, our brains are not fully developed until we're in our mid-20s, right? And that frontal cortex that helps with decision-making and planning and being able to sort of take a deep breath and stop and think before we act, it's not fully developed at all during adolescence, right? Which I reframe it with youth. I say, you know, that's good for you, right? It means that, you know, you can only get better. Like, I'm done, you know, like as an adult in his 40s, this is it, right, for them. But also being mindful of, like, you know, sometimes that lack of impulse control. And I will say also working with And I know sometimes for multiple reasons, this can get challenging to have certain conversations, but also that police officers as first responders and first responders in general, a lot of times they're vicariously traumatized, right? They get to see, for example, we work with police officers who were all part of the victims unit. They were mostly female police officers, so they respond to calls of child abuse, domestic violence, sexual abuse, and they go there when it just happened, right? So how that impacts you, right? And then how are you able to, you know, the next day when you go to work and you see something similar, are you really getting the support that you need to perform your duty? You know, so that's something that, and of course, I'm not saying that's not something that we do at Healing Hurt People, but when it comes to the different levels of public health and the different systems, I think it's also important to understand the role that each system plays and how can we support each other.
Bringing together everything we've talked about, what recommendations might you have to practitioners, researchers, other stakeholders in the space supporting survivors? What would you maybe suggest that those keep in mind about if we're going to have solutions in this space, what to consider?
I will say that as when working with any survivor of trauma and violence, first really acknowledge and validate their experience. And, you know, we talk about believing the victim, which I feel it's another of those statements that sometimes, you know, we use all the time, but yeah, really believing the person's experience, validating and really acknowledging the fact that they trusted you enough to tell you about what happened to them and encouraging people to receive support and help. And I know in these situations, it might be more complex than just trauma therapy because there might be, you know, law involvement or, of course, victims' compensation. But yeah, I think the same principles apply. Treat people with respect, make them feel safe and connected.
Well, thank you so much for a great conversation. It was wonderful to get to talk to you, and we appreciate taking the time.
Thank you, Arturo. Yeah,
likewise. Thank you very much.
Special thanks to Arturo for joining us. To learn more about his work, check out our show notes. And for more about Obscured and our work, you can stay up to date with us on social at Cubenda Media.
Next time on Obscured, we pick up with Emily's reporting about how to support individuals who've experienced law enforcement trauma.
I felt like I was different after experiencing police brutality. I became aware of how my body was reacting after, became aware of how I clenched my teeth and how I was just angry and feeling really isolated and alienated from the rest of society, and so to speak. And so it didn't feel normal to me. It didn't feel like myself. I didn't feel like myself.
Obscured's From Words to Weapons series is produced by Cubenda Media and mixed by Brad Linder. Our series was edited by Diane Hodson and fact-checked by Chelsea Zhu. Malik Calhoun composed the music for this episode and the rest of the series. Stephanie Marudis is Cubenda Media's executive producer and Obscured's co-creator. And I'm executive editor and co-creator of Obscured.
We want to thank Obscured's fiscal sponsor, Media Alliance, which is one of the oldest media change organizations in the United States and helps our podcast receive tax-deductible contributions. And we're grateful to Obscured's founding supporters who've made donations to support our journalism initiative. And if you like what you've heard so far, please join our community of listeners. For more about how to support Obscured, head online to cubendamedia.com/support.
You can also help more people discover Obscured by leaving us a review on your favorite podcast app and sharing the series with others. I'm Emily Previty. Thanks for listening.